Now, here in verse 19, let's pick it up. Is commandment breaking still very important with God? Yes, it is. What is commandment breaking called? Sin, transgression, iniquity. In varying degrees, whatever it is. So he came to the smallest degree, didn't he? Because if you say even the least or the smallest, the one you would count as nothing or less than nothing, I'm telling you. Notice what he says here. Whosoever shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Now, becomes very important. You don't teach men to break commandments of God, not even the least of them. And if God is going to replace it with something greater, God is the one who did it. God is the one who caused the temple to be destroyed. God is the one who terminated the Levitical priesthood. No man did. The Jews wouldn't destroy their temple, would they? No, but God used the Romans to do it. And someone asked the question the other day, they said, is the Western Wall, which is the Wailing Wall, which is the only place the Jews can go to on the Temple Mount, is that part of the temple of God? I said, yeah, it was. It says, well, what about the prophecy where Jesus said that there won't be one stone upon another left standing that you see when he was talking to his disciples concerning the temple, when he was giving the prophecy there in Matthew 24 and Mark 13, Luke 21. The question was, will it again be destroyed? I said, yes, and it's going to be absolutely scraped to nothing to fulfill that prophecy. And if they thought there was hatred toward them back then, just wait until everything is done when they go after Jerusalem again this time. And it's going to be like vehemence we have never understood before. And when I was back in Colorado, we went through the chart, and I didn't find anything where the 9th and 10th of Ab fit or the Feast of Purim. But the question was asked, which I thought was a good question, which is this. Could it be that the final destruction of the temple is going to be on the 9th and 10th of Ab? And I looked at that chart for outline of Revelation number 2, and I thought, boy, that could really fit in there. So it's very possible that it could happen again on the 9th and 10th of Ab, which would be the third time that it happened. And 3 is what? Completion. Okay? Now let's go back here to Matthew 5. So God absolutely abhors breaking of his commandments and teaching men to do so. But he says this, whosoever shall, the King James says do, but the Greek is practice. Now, practice is something you habitually do, and shall teach men so, this one shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now, let's think about this. What is it going to be? What is it going to mean to be called great in the kingdom of heaven? I can't quite answer that question, but let's look at it this way. What did Jesus say of John the Baptist? He said that of those who were born of woman, there is none greater than John the Baptist. And he who is least in the kingdom of heaven shall be greater than he. So he doesn't quite tell us, but that sort of opens the mind of all the possibilities that it could be. I mean, that's quite a profound statement, isn't it? So he says here, the one who teaches the least. Now remember, what was the argument of the disciples as they were getting ready for the Passover, and as also they were sitting at the Passover dinner? What was the argument? Who's going to be the greatest? Okay? People are always arguing over that. Don't argue over that. There's no argument. Christ is going to take care of it, see? And that takes away a lot of the all the vanity and stupidity we've gone through in the past, right? Yes, indeed. Now, he wants us to understand very clearly concerning Judaism. Now, Judaism considered itself, with all of its tradition and all of its written law, the perfection of the greatest of God's laws. They claimed that all the laws that they made were really not legislating new laws, but what they were doing were expanding on the laws of God. So I'm going to take one tape and I'm going to read selected things out of the code of Jewish law. Some good, some bad, some funny, some downright disgusting. So he says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness shall abound above and beyond," that's what it means, "the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of God." Now, when you go back, and especially when I read what they had for their laws, it's going to almost blow your mind how righteous these people considered themselves. What happened was the Pharisees, being a community of religious separatists, said that all of the laws of cleanness, which applied to the priesthood, apply to everyone. So everyone has to practice those laws relating to the priests. So therefore, we will tell you how to do it. And this one I always recall, which is, upon rising in the morning, the first thing you do is wash your hands immediately before you do anything else. And you are to have by your bed a pitcher of water poured out the night before, of course covered so no spirits could get into it. And you are immediately upon rising to wash your hands, and the way you do it is this. You take the pitcher of water in your left hand and you pour it over your right hand. And then you take the pitcher in your right hand and pour it over your left hand and alternately do that three times. Now, this is before you can make any run to any place. Okay? Because it's a sin unless it's an emergency. Okay? Upon rising out of bed, you must wash your hands this way and do it vigorously. You cannot even go to the bathroom and touch anything else on your body, because when you are sleeping, evil spirits descend upon you and they reside in your fingertips in the morning, and you must wash them off. Okay, after you hear that, it sounds like it'll be easy to have better righteousness than they. But that's just one of them. Okay? And the book, The Code of Jewish Laws, has thousands of those laws. Okay? So when he says your righteousness has got to be better, greater, superabound, above and beyond the scribes and Pharisees, what does this first begin with then? What does Jesus teach? The first way your righteousness goes above and beyond the scribes and the Pharisees. First begins with attitude. That's why I did that sermon, Love and the New Covenant, because you can have a legal, lawful relationship, but not have love. Okay? Do you? have a legal, lawful relationship with the city, the county, the state, the U.S. government. Yes, you do. You're obeying the laws. You're a citizen. They have certain obligations to you. You have certain obligation to them, most of which you don't care for because they come in a form of taxes and do this and that and not the other thing. Question. Though you have a perfectly legal relationship with the governments, do you love them? No. Okay. Why? Because their attitude coming down to you is one of taking and robbery and lying and cheating and stealing. Okay? Did not Jesus say that the scribes and Pharisees were hypocrites? Yes. Why were they hypocrites? Because they only had the outward adornment of what they were doing, but they were like what? Sepulchers within, full of dead men's bones within. You see? So when we start seeing what Jesus said here on how that we are to keep the laws, he's making the law complete now by saying the law does not stand in the letter alone, but the law stands because of the attitude required to do it properly. And that's how your righteousness exceeds the laws, exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Let's notice. Okay? Verse 21. And we'll see this all the way through. Verse 21. You have heard that it was said to the ancients, also written too. So when you have something that is said, he's also talking about that which was written. You have heard that it was said to the ancients or in old time, you shall not commit murder. But whosoever shall commit murder shall be liable to the judgment. Now verse 22. But I say to you. So he's talking greater than just the law, right? He's saying, I'm saying to you. You've heard this in the past time. Was this a law of God? Yes. Still is. Says, you shall do no murder. Which is the sixth commandment, right? Yes, indeed. So he's getting right into the laws of God. Why is this important? Who gave the laws of God? God did. Who spoke them? He did. And it was so powerful that the people said after the Ten Commandments to Moses, Moses, we're going to die if we hear any more. You speak to God and you tell us and we'll do what you say. Okay? So he says, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother lightly, doesn't say you can't be angry at him if he really does something wrong, but this is lightly, shall be liable to the judgment. You might want to draw a little line there, okay? Little line there. Because now what is understood in the Greek is this. So I'm going to read what it should be. You have heard it said of old time that whosoever shall say to his brother Raca shall be liable to the Sanhedrin. That's what it is in the Greek. Sanhedrin was a human judgment, right? Okay. But you have heard it said of old time that whosoever shall say to his brother Raca shall be liable to the Sanhedrin. Draw another little line there. But I say to you, okay, that's why it's so difficult when you read that section. It is so difficult to understand. But I say to you, whosoever shall say fool shall be liable to Gehenna fire. Now, is Gehenna fire much more powerful than the Sanhedrin? All the Sanhedrin can do is take your life, correct? But Jesus said, don't be afraid of those who can take your life. Be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in Gehenna. So this last part here should read, but I say to you, whosoever shall say fool shall be liable to the fire of Gehenna, or the Gehenna of fire. Now notice what else he starts out with, verse 23. Verse 23, and is he not hitting right at the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees? We'll see that he is. Verse 23, if therefore you shall offer your gift at the altar. Now, the altar symbolized what? Coming into the very presence of God, right? Bringing something upon which you would offer, the smoke would ascend right up to God as a sweet-smelling savor, either as a peace offering, or a thank offering, or a sin offering, or a votive offering, whatever it would be. So that's why he says at the altar. Okay? And there shall remember that your brother has something against you. Leave your gift there before the altar and go away first. Be reconciled to your brother. And then, having come, offer your gift. Isn't that something? He starts all of his teaching concerning the individual application of the law and the prophets, that you got to have the right attitude first, and you better make peace with your brother. Now, why would he say that? Because later on you're going to see that if you don't have peace with your brother, you can't have peace with God. What did James say? Let's go back to the book of James here for just a minute. And this, brethren, I will tell you, and you know, and I know from experience, okay, that this is the hardest thing in the world to do, isn't it? Yes. That's why he starts there. The hardest thing in the world to do is to be at peace with your brother if you've had a dispute. The hardest thing in the world to do is to hold your tongue. I know. I've stepped on it. Other people have stepped on it while it's been out there doing its dirty work. Okay? Thankfully, God is not there with a big sword to hack it off every time our tongue runs amok. Because that wouldn't solve the problem. God wants the change from the inside, which controls the tongue. Okay? Now, verse 8, James 3. Now, this is my translation of it, which I did in a series, so it may be a little bit different than your King James. Okay? James 3 and verse 8. But the tongue no human being is able to tame. Which means that the only way you're ever going to succeed is keep working at it, and with the Spirit of God, get it tamed. That means conquered, under control, not wild, but domesticated. Okay? It is an unrestrainable evil, full of death-dealing poison. That's what it means in the Greek. I mean, this is sharp. Okay, so when I'm saying this, I'm putting daggers in you and me at the same time. Okay? Now, here's the irony of it. With it, we're blessing God the Father, and with it, we ourselves, and it's the middle verb, the Greek middle verb, okay? Which means you, your own self. Notice he says, we. Is James including himself in it? Yes. The very brother of the Lord was admitting the hardest problem in the world. Okay? With it, we are blessing God the Father, and with it, we ourselves are cursing people who are made in the likeness of God. Now, it becomes a great pain to restrain some things. So we have to modify that just a little bit by saying that, did Jesus have perfect control of his tongue? Yes. Did Jesus get angry at times? Yes, he even healed in anger. Did he speak very sharply at times? Yes. Did he also condemn very roundly at times? Yes. Okay? But he never cursed. Did he? No. So there's the difference. Okay? And with it, we ourselves are cursing people who have been made in the likeness of God. For out of the same mouth is coming blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. So that's where Jesus starts. And it's an ongoing lesson all of your life. And I think in this situation, all of us are going to be at a varying level of accomplishment in it. And sometimes it will vary greatly depending on whether you have a temper or whether you are impetuous, whether you are impulsive, whether you like to speak or whatever it may be. Okay, so he's dealing with that and he's saying, before you do anything for God or me in keeping the laws which I'm making complete, get everything squared around with your brother and yourself. Otherwise, all of your religion is worthless. That's what he's saying. And doesn't that, you know, I say that. And as I said before, I am pointing to myself. So if this feels like it's reaching down and grabbing your gut, it is me too. And I have a lot of things that I need to go back and work on and rehash and redo and get taken care of. But I am trying. Okay? And I hope you are. Okay? Now, then he comes to verse 25, which is a very interesting verse. He's giving a little sound advice how to keep yourself out of great, long, and protracted disputes. Verse 25, be agreeing with your adversary party quickly while you are in the way with him, lest the adversary party deliver you to the judge and the judge deliver you to the officer and you be cast into prison. I mean, once you're in the jug, it's pretty tough. Verse 26, verily I say to you, that if you take and you take it that far. Now, I will have to say this woman who's being tried up here, what's this town? Nora. Sonora. She shot the child molester that molested her son, who was a known child molester, many repeated cases again. God would sanction that killing. You go back in the Old Testament, that if someone did something worthy of death to some of your family, you could go get them. Okay? And I just hope that the jury says not guilty. Because that man, when the kid came in to testify against him, he smiled at the boy and then smirked at the mom with the distinct implication in what he was doing in those behaviors was, I'm going to be out in a couple of years and I'm going to do it again. So those things like that, you know, that's why everything is so screwy and upside down in the world today, is because people are not even following the letter of God's laws. So I hope she gets off. Okay? But if you get yourself in a situation that you're going to be fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting these things, sometimes they even try to agree with your adversary. Here's another example, Leona Helmsley. Okay? She was made out to really be a bad person. She wasn't. They paid, what was it? $5 million in taxes that year, and she owed a couple hundred thousand. Or they paid something like $20 million over the years, and she owed $1 million. She was willing to pay it, but they wouldn't take it. So there are times when you get into a situation with your adversary that even your adversary is not going to listen. Because the federal government wanted to make an example out of a rich person and not paying their taxes. And guess for what purpose? So that when this tax bill came down on the rich, you better pay. Okay? Now let's come back here to Matthew, the 5th chapter, and verse 27. You have heard that it was said to the ancients or in old time, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks upon a woman to lust after her, of course, and that's in his heart, has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Where does all adultery and rape and child molestation and perversion begin? In the first place. So again, he's saying, get your mind and your attitude straightened out. And what do you need to do that? You need the Spirit of God. Does that not make the law of God complete? Because he's saying in old time, it says, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But everyone would say, but that can't keep me from thinking. So Christ is saying, the thought is what leads to the sin, and the thought itself, being the initializing of the sin, is sin. That's why in 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, it says, when a temptation comes, we are to be casting down thoughts and vain imaginations and bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Is this not the obedience of Christ? Yes, because these are the words of Christ. Yes, absolutely. Okay? Now, he shows how hard you're to work on this. And, of course, as I've said before, let's read this now. But if your right eye cause you to offend, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it is profitable for you that you should... One of your members should perish, then your whole body be cast into Gehenna. Now, what is Gehenna? The lake of fire. What is the lake of fire? The second death. I mean, he's putting this on a level of prime importance, right? No longer is it that these things are going to result in going to court or going before the Sanhedrin. But it's going to be going before God, and the ultimate punishment is the second death. That's what he's saying here. Okay? And if your right hand offend you, cut it off from you and cast it from you, for it is profitable that one of your members should perish and not your whole body be cast into Gehenna. Now then, it is literally true, I suppose. Well, as a matter of fact, it could be literally true. If you don't overcome lusting, taking out your eyes won't help, because you can still see in the eye of your mind. Correct? Cutting off your hands because you may be stealing, as some of the more radical Arab countries do, and they can always tell a thief because one hand is missing. Habitual, he's no longer habitual, he has neither hand. Okay? But he can still lust and covet and plan for others to steal, right? Can't he? She could cut off both legs, both arms, cut off the ears and plug them up so you can't hear, pull out your eyes, take out your tongue, and lie in bed with a breathing apparatus and still lust. So the reason he brings this out is to show that you have got to overcome from within. You can't overcome from without. You can only overcome and change from within. Now let's go to the next one and we'll end here. Verse 31 and 32. It was said, also said, that whosoever shall put away his wife. Now notice, he just says said. He didn't say who said it. He didn't say it was the ancients that said it. But it is also said that whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a bill of divorcement or a letter of divorce. And they could do that. Man could come home and say, I don't like you. Write it out. I hereby so-and-so on this day, such and such, hereby divorce you and release you as my wife. Okay? She could take that out and go get married again. But Jesus called it a wicked and an adulterous generation. Okay? Verse 32. But I say to you, now this is pretty powerful legislation here, that whosoever shall put away his wife, or that is divorce her, except on account of pornea, which is sexual immorality. It's translated into New King James, sexual immorality, which is any kind of sexual behavior that breaks the bond of one flesh, being husband and wife. And today there are many different avenues and varieties of sin, sexual sins, which are cause for divorce. But the only one who can make the decision is the offended party. The offended party must say, I am going to put you away. Then that looses the marriage right there. If the offended party says, well, no, I don't want to put you away, but I want you to change and repent and reform. So if they repent and change and reform and everything is fine from there on, then it's a binding marriage. You can't come along later and say, well, I changed my mind. Okay? Now we have some things that we've done in divorce and remarriage, which those of you who really have an interest in it, I'll let it be made available to you. Okay? Needless to say, there are people who are going around, and now you think of this. All of what I said up to this point of what should be the converted mind's approach to keeping the commandments and laws of God. There are some people who have actually said, I don't like my wife or I don't like my husband, so they actually go out and commit adultery so then the other person can have grounds to put them away. Or, I like someone else over in this other church over here, rather than my husband or my wife over here. And so what I am going to do is I'm going to make myself so miserable that I'm going to be declared a non-believer. And the ministers, brethren, have done this. I did not realize. But in the so-called largest church of God organization, 55 to 58% of all of the members have been divorced and remarried within the church to church members. I never knew that situation existed. I mean, it's unreal. And people have done things just as vicious as what I've said. There have even been cases where there was a problem in a marriage and they went to counsel and the minister told the husband, you're not to say a word. He didn't say a word, and he listened to all that the wife said and declared that he was unconverted and that the marriage was not binding, so therefore she could leave and marry this other guy. So you see what happens in this. These are living words. Who would ever have thought that we look back in our years in the church that that thing would be within the church of God and violating exactly what Jesus said here with impunity? Now, there are going to be a lot of people going to have to pay for that because there are a lot of people who are involved in it. Especially when you look back and see where it says, oh, my people, those that lead you have led you astray.